Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
That was very dramatic. I haven't heard that dramatic intro from you before.
In a world where Android Studio.
It almost sounded like radio.
That's what this is. It's internet radio.
And don't tune that dial. This is Chet Haas from the Android Toolkit team.
And I'm Romain Guy from the Android Framework team something.
Sort of. You really need a name for your team.
6 months without a name?
More than that.
Well, it got even more complicated lately. I'm doing even more things, so it's really hard to describe my job now.
Random bucket of stuff. RBOS. Right. Yeah. RBOS.
RBOS. I like that's what Romain will be one day.
So we are here, and who's the guest today? It is Romain. We are talking about stuff that you've been cranking on secretly, privately for a while, and then finally got exposed to the real world. Actually, through AR under the covers, but
through
directly.
AR under the cover, yes.
So that is so Filament is the rendering engine for AR, which came out at I/O, and now just got released in open source.
That's right. It's on GitHub.
Awesome. So,
I guess you haven't picked a name for that either, since names are hard.
No, I helped pick the name.
Oh, what is the name
for Filament?
Oh,
it's Filament.
Filament. Okay.
You got me confused here.
I was playing dumb.
But how do you say it in French?
Filament.
Oh, very tricky.
Yeah, secretly it's a French name.
And what does it mean?
The same thing as it does in English. It's the same word.
Okay.
So, what is it besides a name?
So, it is what's called a real-time 3D physically based renderer for Android, Windows, Linux, and macOS.
Okay.
So, and what does it mean to be physically based?
That is a very good question that is very difficult to answer.
Does that mean that you don't render pure spheres?
No,
like
it's not.
Every ray tracer in the world?
It's not.
Checkerboards.
Yeah, so typically physically based rendering is a term that you hear when it comes to offline ray tracers or path tracing, the kind of stuff that Disney or Pixar use. But over the past few years, it's been getting traction in the world of real-time rendering, so in games. And the idea behind physically based rendering is to have a principled approach to your rendering, and it's trying to mimic some of the physical foundations behind light in the real world. And of course, we can do it right in real time because we just don't have the power, with the latest GPUs on desktop, like it's just too complicated. So we have to take a lot of shortcuts, but we take informed decisions, and we know that we're taking those shortcuts, and we know why. So it's just, you know, having a more, a more principled approach. Like you actually know what you're doing instead of just, you know, changing your code until it looks good.
So yeah, I mean, looking at your renderings, it seems like, you know, classic rendering is sort of everything looks plastic, right? Whereas with your renderings, you're simulating materials, or at least appearing to simulate materials, so you can see different, you know, characteristics.
Right, and that's a very what you mentioned, the plasticity of the materials is a very good description. If you play older games from the early days of the PlayStation 3 or Xbox 360 era, or even before that, one big component that's missing from a lot of materials was called the specular lighting. So it's all the reflections, the light bouncing off objects, and just took a long time for real-time programmers effectively to recognize that every object in the real world has that specular element. It's pretty obvious on metals or things like mirrors, but it's even there on cardboard, on paper, on things that looks, you know, very diffuse, but it's there. And just adding it makes things look so much better. And it's one of the key components behind physically based rendering is identifying all those little behaviors of, you know, real-world surfaces and trying to recreate them.
You said physically based, but then in your description you said, and then we take a bunch of shortcuts because that's how you get real time, right? So when you talked about Pixar and Disney using, you know, ray tracing things and they're doing it offline and they're doing these overnight renderings on those frames, we don't have time to do that if we're trying to run at 60 frames a second, right?
Right.
So there's physically based and then there's physically-ish.
Well, even those offline renderers are physically based, but they still don't do things right either, because it's just way too expensive.
Got it. So they also simulate things at the molecular level.
Right. They also take shortcuts. They do a lot of things to be able to render things, you know, even in a few hours. Like they need to go fast because they have to render a whole movie.
So when I was in grad school, this is over 20 years ago now, radiosity was the state of the art in computer graphics, you know, and the idea there was you need to sort of bounce light off all the light surfaces back and forth. And that's kind of like in a cathedral, you'll sort of see this light lit area without an obvious light source.
Right. Yeah. It was accounting for all the energy in the scene, right?
Exactly.
From all of the surfaces that were going to
very heavy math
reflect it.
And very expensive. And is that something that, you know, are there simplifications for that now? Does filament?
So in real time, typically there are a number of techniques to do that. We don't do any of those in Firmament because they're still expensive, or they would require to build very complex tools. But typically in real time rendering, usually engines use something called light maps, where you bake lighting ahead of time. So you pre-compute objects that you know won't move, and with light sources that you know won't change. You just pre-compute everything into textures. And then there are advanced versions of that where what we pre-compute is not the final color of the texture, but it's the energy that the point on that texture receives. And then you can reconstruct the lighting at runtime. And over the past few years, there's been a number of improvements. So now you create voxels. So you split the world into millions of cubes and you try to gather energy through those cubes. And then you can recreate the lighting at runtime. But that is also still, you know, a lot of approximations. They look good. They look much better than not having them, but they're still not correct.
So actually, I feel the need to take a step back and maybe discuss what are the major different approaches to rendering. So back when I was in grad school, probably a similar time, maybe a little bit earlier, the radiosity was just coming online. It was the new hotness that was being used for like photorealistic rendering. But the real-time modeling was just like it was using, well, you've got an ambient and you have a diffuse and you have a specular term and that's about
so
it.
That
and
is
then
more
it was
about,
ray tracing.
Yeah, that's more about the lighting. The actual rendering techniques, there's a couple. There's ray tracing.
Yeah.
That's the concept is for every pixel on screen, you shoot a ray into the world and you find a surface that it hits. Then you can compute the lighting on that surface, and then you can, you know, there are variants of ray tracing where you start bouncing that ray off. So if it's a very smooth surface, it's going to bounce off somewhere else, and you're going to gather the light there, you're going to get the reflections, all those things. And then there's the rasterization technique. So that's what we do typically with OpenGL and Vulkan, and that's what we use on Android everywhere, where you send a bunch of triangles to the GPU. Instead of for every pixel on the screen, you shoot res, you go the other way around. For every triangle, you try to figure out what pixels the triangle covers, and then you just fill that triangle.
Right, but that's not accounting for reflections, which is why you're not going to get the photorealistic.
Right, but so that's where things become complicated and a little murky, is because there are techniques that, for instance, we use in Filament where you can recreate some of those reflections. For instance, reflections from that are kind of at infinity, like the sky or the horizon.
Yep.
You can use things like an environment map. It's often called image-based lighting.
Yep.
So you can get reflections from the environment. Then there are techniques where you can have local environment maps that have to be parallax corrected. So as you move through the world, we're basically going to change the image we pick as a source of reflections. So that only works for static reflections. Then when you want dynamic reflections, there are some kind of hybrid technologies where, so a popular one these days is called screen space reflections. So it's a form of ray tracing, but that's very limited. And it's heavily used in games today. I personally don't like it because it can only use information that's already on screen. And if you play a game that's using this technique, you can notice, for instance, when you're in front of a body of water where you see a lot of reflections, if there's a character between you and the water, around the character, you're going to see some kind of a halo where the reflections are missing because they're not on screen. So there's no way you can get that information. And recently, NVIDIA announced new GPUs for the desktop that can do hardware accelerated ray tracing.
Yeah.
And a bunch of games have been announced where they mix the rasterization techniques with the ray tracing techniques to get more accurate reflections and shadows. And really, over the past 10 years in real time, like a number of techniques are mixed together to get good results.
I love the idea that now, because of advanced GPU technology, we can play checkers in real time.
So what I'm hearing is that Filament has a lot of these recent improvements to physically based rendering in real time.
Yes, that's entirely correct.
It's basically built into our AR support. Is it something that you can use standalone to build a game as well?
Right. Yeah. So that's a very good question. So at Google.io, we announced something called Synform. It's a framework and its tools to be able to build AR applications. And as part of Synform, you can also build just regular 3D applications. You don't have to do augmented reality. So, and Synform under the hood uses Filament as the rendering engine. It doesn't expose all the capabilities of Filament yet because they just have different end goals. But Synform also gives you a lot of nice utilities, like a plugin for Android Studio where you can see your meshes and textures, ways to load your textures and your models and do collisions, things like that. Filament itself is just a rendering engine. So if you need a file format to store your textures, you have to create your own. If you need a file format to create your models, you have to create your own. It is just a rendering engine.
Right, so now some dumb questions for me. So AR is where you basically take sort of the real background video and you overlay objects, right? So does that mean that Filament can sort of render just an object without the environment around it? Or is it more meant for VR, where you're sort of in the whole 3D world?
So it can be used for both. One of the, what's difficult about AR, so you want to place an object in the world and you want the object to look like it's part of the world. And yeah, that's where a physically based renderer helps, because we're able to recreate surfaces that look reasonably photorealistic. But then there's still the problem of lighting. Ideally, we would need to be able to recreate the exact lighting that's in the scene. So AR Core, that's used by Synform, will try to estimate the ambient lighting so that will at least give us an idea of how dark or bright the object should be, and that works really well.
So AR Core figures out sort of the scene coordinates, like the orientation, right, and all that stuff, and some lighting, and then you go and render the object.
Exactly. But what AR Core doesn't tell us at this point is where the light is coming from. So we know the intensity kind of the light, but we don't know its direction. So for shadows, what we do right now is there's a light in the scene. And if you pay attention, in a lot of situations, the shadows are going the wrong way.
Because you're guessing based on the orientation that the light's going to be a little bit above, a little bit
exactly.
to the left. Kind
that's
of
why
thing.
AR stands for approximate reality.
And then the other problem is all the source of reflections we were just mentioning, so the entire environment. So if you have a shiny surface as your AR object, what are the reflections we should put on the object? So today what we do is there's a default environment that looks like it's the inside of a house, and I mean a house, not your house, a house. And most of the time, if your surface is not super shiny, like it will, the reflections will look accurate enough that, you know, there's enough going on the object that you feel like it's working.
Right, but I mean, could you not? I understand the camera is pointing in the wrong direction, but if you assume that the scene you're in is somewhat symmetrical, could you not just could you get the video from AR Core,
right,
and use that as the environment map?
So it's more complicated than that, because we need 360 degrees of imaging.
Yeah, so you could be aiming the camera down, but the opposite direction is the sky.
Right,
so
exactly. Or even, you know, inside a building, like if the door is behind you and it's a glass door and there's a bright light coming out of it,
yeah,
and in front of you it's dark, like it's not going to work.
Okay. In fact, most of the information is wrong, because you are looking into the scene, which means for the most part, it should be reflecting stuff that is behind
exactly.
you, which is not part of the scene.
Yeah, I was thinking in the room case, it would kind of work if you're sort of aiming towards the horizon, but I guess it does not work.
Potentially, you could ask the user to, you know, quickly like do a sweep of the environment, but that's not a super good experience.
Well, could you
experience.
Use the other camera? Can we? I don't know if our hardware allows it. Can you turn on both cameras?
With the camera to API, I believe you can, because we have a multi-camera API. The problem is the user stands in front of the camera.
Well, the computation of these environment maps, I mean, is that expensive as well?
Right, and that's the other problem is those, first of all, you would have to capture the environment, stitch the environment, and ideally what you want is produce an HDR image, so you can't just take one photo, you need to take multiple photos.
And then upload all these as textures.
Right, well, and more importantly, you need to run fairly expensive computations on those pictures to convert them to something we can use in real time. It's called pre-filtered environment mapping, and we have to run like large integrations over each pixel. And it takes, you know, on a powerful machine, it can take a few seconds. You can run that on the GPU, but in the meantime, especially on a phone, you can't do very much else.
So rates of like 60 seconds a frame,
something like that.
Okay.
I'm just curious. Have you investigated trying to train a machine learning model on pictures to figure out where the light source is? I mean, it seems like that actually could work.
Right. I haven't. I'm sure someone is doing that somewhere. Because actually, machine learning seems to work really well in the context of graphics and real-time graphics. And actually, one of the advances, so some of the stuff that NVIDIA showed with the real-time ray tracing, what they're relying on is you can't shoot enough rays, so you end up with an image that's very noisy. So they use machine learning to denoise the image, and that seems to be working really well. So yeah, that's an area that definitely could be explored.
All right.
So if some situations are not appropriate for the renderer, like, you know, creating environment maps on the fly. What are the game or the application possibilities that could really take advantage of this renderer, where I guess the scenes or at least the backgrounds should be static to enable the kind of performance that people need?
Right. So one of the things you can do is, again, if you avoid like fairly smooth surfaces like perfect mirrors, which are actually fairly rare, especially large flat areas that are perfectly smooth.
Yeah, except in ray tracing demos.
Yeah, where they except in ray tracing demos. Yeah. But like right in front of me.
That's really where they shine.
The mic stand, for instance, is very, very smooth. But because it's a small tube, it's very hard to tell what the reflections actually are. So you can fool the user pretty well. And based on the application, if you know your application is going to be used mostly indoors or outdoors, you can pick an environment map that, you know, does a reasonable job at approximating the kind of environment your users are going to be in. And if you want to be really fancy, you could have, you know, one for night, one for day, and based on the clock of the phone, you could pick one or the other.
But then would it be able to incorporate characters in the scene? So let's say, you know, you're on a raiding party and there's a couple of other characters running around the scene, and you can do a fair approximation of, you know, the environment around you, but what about, you know, the characters that are running past the mirrored ball?
Yes, that you could do, but it's expensive. It's very expensive to do on the GPU. And typically, it's only games that do this tend to be racing games, because, you know, you see your car and you, like, when you go under a bridge, you want to see the bridge reflecting the car, but almost nobody else cares.
Yeah.
Very expensive.
Okay.
So you said this is something you can use to build games with. What other kinds of applications?
You could build games with it, but it's not a game engine. It's only a rendering engine. Mm-hmm. So you would still have to build everything else, AI collisions, you know, controls, all that stuff. The idea was more to bridge the gap. Today on Android, if you want to render something in 3D, or, you know, just something that looks good that goes beyond canvas, either you can use Unreal Engine or Godot, which is a great open source game engine, or Unity. Those are big engines that add a lot to your APK. And for Unreal and Unity, they even generate the APK for you. So it can be very difficult to integrate that into an existing application. And on the other end of the spectrum, there's OpenGL and Vulkan, where suddenly it's like you have to go learn the OpenGL API, which, you know, is a lot to learn. And Vulkan is even lower level, and it's more difficult to learn.
And so, there's not a big learning curve with Filament, because you're just going to be loading scene objects and rendering
So Filament, sits somewhere in the middle, where we took care of writing all the shaders, talking to OpenGL, we talked to Vulkan on your behalf. It runs on multiple computers. So all you have to worry about is loading your assets in a format that makes sense for you, and then creating a scene. So you create a camera, you create what we call renderables, you position them in the scene, and then we take care of everything else.
And it's nice that it also runs on desktop for purely selfish reasons, because in Android Studio, when you want to click on some of the AR asset files, we give you a full preview. And what is running behind the scenes? Filament.
It's also for selfish reasons for ourselves. Turns out it's nice when you iterate on an algorithm or shader to just be able to run it, you know, natively on your desktop, instead of having to build a full Android app, send it to a phone. Just cuts down on development times a little bit. Makes our life a little harder, because instead of dealing with, you know, just the OpenGL drivers on Android, now we have to deal with the OpenGL drivers of everything else. So we run into fun bugs and problems here and there.
I should point out another advantage to Filament from my selfish perspective is, for the people that care about how things work, it also bridges the gap of having the tools available that allow you to see the rendering, but also being able to understand what the hell is going on. I have to give kudos to the doc that you posted, which
it's
is
an amazing
huge
doc.
And an amazing explanation of a lot of really complicated stuff, a lot of which remains complicated after you read it. But the discussion on scattering in surfaces and like clear coat, metal versus plastic, all these different materials, like the diagrams and the equations in there, like understanding it from the document, and then also being able to play with the rendering engine and change the materials. And like, I think it's made this kind of rendering much more approachable than simply, well, you know, you take on Unity and it comes out the other end.
Right. Yeah, one of the issues we ran into when we started working on this was, so it was a few years ago, and there was not that much information available about physically based rendering in real time. There was some, but it was hard. But it was scattered across many different papers and presentations.
It's all about scattering.
Right, exactly. So it was hard. Like, you know, we read hundreds of research papers and presentations, and you have to take like bits and pieces from all of them. And a lot of the work And again, because you know it's only physically based, and for some of those, a lot of the equations we use are just based on measurements, and someone tries to fit an equation that matches those measurements. So it's not like we know. There's no like one right equation. Like they get better and better over time, or we prove that it happens that the one we're using is correct. But sometimes there's several different equations you could be using, and the question is which one should you pick. So there's a lot of research to do, like to understand those papers, like try it, yep. You know, pick the one that makes sense for you.
I remember trying to render thin film interference, and I started from the physics side, like with the actual physics formulas. Didn't look right, because of course you're missing something. And if right. you instead just go after the effect you want from all the angles, you sort of get better results through heuristics, because it's probably pulling in some factors that your physics wasn't simulating.
Yeah, and that's real-time rendering in a nutshell. Like in the end, what matters is that it looks right. And I'll get back to some of that. Some of the approximations we do are ridiculous, but they work. And so, you know, because we had to read so many papers, and some of them can be pretty difficult to understand, they're not written with the average programmer like us in mind. After months and months of trying to understand those things and finally starting to get results that seem correct, we decided to start writing a single document that would explain all you need to learn to know about physically based rendering so you could create your own. And our guiding principle was, if tomorrow we lose the source code of filament from that document, we should be able to recreate the most complex pieces. So anything that's related to the equations and the math, like it's right there.
Just get Git. this is a solved problem, Romain.
Yeah, but maybe someone wants to create to create their own engine, and you know, that's a good.
That document
that's
is
a
amazing.
Good reference.
It feels like a computer graphics textbook,
yeah,
honestly,
exactly.
And a high production one, you know, with color pictures, yep.
and all the references as well. Because it's important to point out, like you, at no point are you like, we've invented this amazing thing. It was more like you're collating and collecting, yep, all of this information across, you know, the graphics industry for the last few decades in a single place to make it more understandable for the needs that you had for the engine, but also in a way that people can then understand how you put the stuff together.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And also some of the things we try to explain in the document is how do you parameterize those equations? Like what are the parameters you expose to your users to make it easy to create a new material, a new surface? It's also about some of the pragmatic choices for the implementation. So a good example is, on mobile, when you run your shaders on the GPU, you can run your computations either using full single precision floats, so 32-bit floats, or you can pick half floats, so only 16-bit. Half floats are much faster because, you know, basically you can run twice as many computations as with the regular floats.
Half gives you double. Let me write that.
Kind
down.
Of.
Hang on.
But I want to understand how that's possible.
But the problem is, with half floats, you don't have the same precision nor the same range that you have with regular floats. And a lot of those equations that everybody's using, nobody has really tried to use them on mobile with half floats. So you have to change
See
them
if
a
it
little
works.
Bit.
Right.
Right. Like it's interesting, for instance, you have an equation, and by just writing an equivalent equation that gives you the same result, but you get there with slightly different mathematical operators. Suddenly, all the work can be done in half float without breaking the precision or the range. For instance, something that you should avoid with floats is subtracting them, especially between 0 and 1, because you can get what's called cancellations, and you lose all your precision. So we have a couple places where we have like reformulations of the equations, yep, to avoid that. And it's explained in the document, which I don't think I've seen in other documents before. Certainly not in research papers, because that's not what they worry about.
Right. So, back to the half float thing then.
Yeah, because at least on the desktop, you know, typically you only use float instead of double if you're needing to store it somewhere, because, you know, it's half the storage. But computation-wise, everything gets widened to double anyway for the floating coprocessor. So it's kind of, you know, like it's not...
No, it's not. It's not true. So I don't know enough about desktop CPUs, but I doubt they work this way. But for instance, on mobile, we have the same thing with the Neon units. So you have registers that are shared effectively. So if you use smaller data types, you can fit more of them and do more operations at the same time than if you use the wider data types.
Okay. So how does it work that it can do twice as much in parallel?
So I don't know enough about the actual GPU hardware, because it's very hard to find the information, but that's effectively how it works out. I imagine that the ALUs are able to just work on half of the bits in a register versus all the bits in the register.
I assume it's vector operations.
I can understand how it can only look at half the bits, but it seems like if you're doing two at the same time, it has to like treat the upper half and lower half in parallel and not have overflow between
them. It's not necessarily that it's going to do two at the same time, but it's going to be faster at doing
one. Oh, I see. So you could do it twice. Okay, yeah. I understand.
And also, you're going to save a ton of bandwidth, which is very important with GPUs and especially on mobile where bandwidth is at a premium.
Actually, and I should clarify, I think that maybe the issue I'm thinking of is that when it comes to like all, like for example, the Java 2D APIs, they're all double anyway. So you doing float on your side isn't helping.
Yeah, so yeah, Java 2D was maybe a little ahead of its time. And it's interesting because on desktop, they're also... They went to full float for everything, and now they're going back to half floats because, well, you can do more. And for a lot of computations, you don't need the full precision or the full range of regular floats. So you may as well save some power and bandwidth.
So you introduced half float in the former release, didn't you? You were working with
Android,
color stuff.
In Android O, there's an API for half floats. Because they turn out to be extremely useful for graphics, if only because you can store a lot of information in, well, half the space.
Right.
So they show up in HDR images. They're useful for that. They're useful for even models, 3D models. Instead of using full floats, most of the time you can just use half floats. But you have to be careful because the precision issues and the range issues can lead you to trouble if you're not super careful. I remember playing a couple of years ago No Man's Sky that came out on PlayStation 4.
No Man's Sky.
And that's the European version. And someone had this YouTube video where they were wondering, like, how far away can they get from the current solar system where they were? And they thought they found an Easter egg because at some point your ship leaves a trail behind, like a cool-looking, you know, glowy trail. And suddenly that trail would look like stair steps. And like, oh, look, this is really cool. If you go far enough, you can see this cool effect. And then when I saw that, my first reaction was, no. You just lost all your precision in your floating points. And the game engine is not accounting for that, so that nice trail cannot be a curve anymore. It goes like into stair steps.
I love the idea that
in real world,
it's like the future version of the flat Earth theory, where you know if you go close enough to the edge, you can simply fall off the Earth. There's like an aliasing thing out at infinity that we can hit.
And so those are some of the things we cover in the document, and we also explain sometimes a couple of the approximations. So. That's what I call graphics math. You know, if it looks correct, it is correct. One of the ones I like, we're going to stick with, you know, high school math, but we have at some point in one of the equations, we have to compute a square root of a sum of squares. And, you know, the square root of a square is just x. And so for a square root of a sum of squares, like, well, what if you just remove all the squares and the square root? Like, it's kind of the same. And turns out for the values we use in the ranges that we use, they're all between 0 and 1, it's close enough that the result on screen is not different enough that, you know, it's worth like doing the real thing and losing performance on mobile. On desktop, I would definitely do the right thing. But
so the API for this thing, I assume that this is a native library.
Right. It's all written in C++. Okay. And we do have a nice C++ API, but we also have Java bindings. So we have
We have
a JNI layer. So that's why we use inside Android Studio and inside of Synform. We can compile Ferment as an AAR for Android, and it comes with a set of Java classes that are as close as possible to the C++ API. Some things are a little bit different to be a little nicer for Java. But yeah, we do have Java bindings.
Are there caveats around that? I remember for the GL bindings, things got a little bit weird. Like the way that you would optimally pass around, you know, buffers of information at the native level get a little squirrely in Java.
Yeah, we have similar issues, and that's more because of Java and its APIs than Ferment. So the main one is when you want to build, let's say, a texture or 3D mesh with the C++ API. All you have to give us is a pointer to a chunk of memory and tell us, yeah, this is a bunch of floats or a bunch of ints, whatever you want. With Java, we can't really do that, so we use the NIO buffers.
Yeah.
So you can give us, but we try to make things as easy as possible, so they can be byte buffer, short buffer, int buffer, like any type of buffer. They can be direct or not, because byte buffers have both modes. They can be backed by an array or not. Like, we'll handle all that stuff in our JNI layer.
As efficiently as possible.
As efficiently as possible and as efficient as it can be. But it works really well in practice. The only thing where you have to be really careful is OpenGL and Vulkan being fairly low-level APIs, they expect the memory that you give them to be in the endianness of your CPU. but Java byte buffers by default are always little endian. So you have, when you create one of those buffers, you have to set the byte order to be the native order of the CPU, or you're going to get really strange results. I just ran into that issue myself yesterday when I was writing a sample app for Filament for Android. It took me 20 minutes to remember to do that.
Can you just write the code in the opposite order?
You could write your constant, yeah, in the opposite order if you want, but that's...
I mean, if there's some sort of canonical fragment where you sort of see a direct buffer allocation and then there's later a Filament call, I mean, that seems like something we could have a lint check for.
We could do a lint check, or I suppose that Filament could check the byte order on the buffer that it receives. And
it doesn't know what the data represents. It doesn't know,
and that's why we didn't do it this way, but yeah, there could be a... But yeah, a lint check would be a good idea.
Filolint.
Yeah, filolint.
So I'm surprised about the pointer. Wouldn't it just be a jint? Isn't that the workaround for JNI? Is you sort of allocated the native level?
Right, but the problem is that when you're inside your Java-based or Kotlin-based application, like you have your array of floats, or
how
do you pass that down? Yeah. And that's where, you know, like as much as I love Kotlin and Java, when it comes to graphics, they can be a little annoying because it's very hard to create just an array of things, like low-level things, like vertices.
With Kotlin Native, do they have some sort of concept of passing around handles that could make this easier?
So I'm not familiar enough with Kotlin Native. I don't even know what's the story with the JNI integration, but there's definitely something I want to look into to see if it could make things easier.
Kotlin Native, I don't know if there would be a JNI story.
Like. Right. Or a way to, and one of the issues, because our API is in C++, you run into ABI compatibility issues.
Well, I'm assuming you would write Kotlin Native code that is basically directly linked with your Filament. The question is then how do you access that Kotlin library now from Java, which presumably they have some sort of story where you can recompile it to get the API.
I don't think they have that right now, but I haven't looked at Kotlin Native in a while. But I have high expectations for it.
Well, Kotlin Conf is in what, a little over a month? So
yeah, you'll be there.
I'll be there too. All right.
I won't.
Chet?
Nope.
Chet still doesn't know what Kotlin is.
Try to have fun without me. Just try. I dare you. So what next? So this came out in open source about a month ago-ish. Mm-hmm. So all of the code is out there. People should check out. People are doing pull requests on this thing. They're submitting changes, I assume.
Right, yes. We received already a bunch of contributions, mostly around the build system and typos in the documentation, which I really appreciate. Just yesterday, someone was contributing fixes to the Windows build hasn't received enough love so far.
Yeah,
but all the development is being done on GitHub right now, so people can see just in real time like what we're doing. For instance, this week, Philip, who's on my team, was making Filament run with WebAssembly. So now you can run Filament in your web browser.
Whoa!
And it's pretty cool. He just sent me a link over Hangouts. I clicked on it, and there it was, Filament running inside the web view inside Hangouts. Which is pretty cool. So one of the next steps will probably be to create a JavaScript API, so you can use it directly from JavaScript, and that would make it even easier to create like beautiful renderings.
That would be awesome, because what the web really needs is other programming frameworks for doing things in the browser. Because I don't think it was confusing enough.
No, but
I'm thinking how many physically based lightweight rendering.
Right, so I see the need for it, but I also see that, oh my God, something else I need to learn.
the web has the same issue. I mean, you have WebGL, but again, it's slightly higher level than the GL we know, but it's still fairly low level.
But it's still GL, yeah.
And there's very popular frameworks like 3.js, which actually I hacked 3.js to write prototypes of Filament in WebGL years ago. Hmm. But 3.js is a full-blown engine. It goes way beyond what Filament does. And now they're physically based rendering, but it's just different approaches. And the nice thing is, compared to WebAssembly, Filament is super tiny. I think it's when it's gzipped over the wire, it's something like 150 kilobytes.
Wow,
that's tiny.
Yeah, it's actually something we're very careful about. One of the reasons we wanted to help app developers do, like, you know, if you want fancy 3D in your application, if you take Unity, it's going to add 10, 20 megs, something like that. So we wanted Filament to be as small as possible. So right now, per CPU architecture you target, Filament adds about 400 kilobytes once it's inside your APK.
Yeah, I mean, I think having the mobile constraint has been really good for filament, right? That you always had that as a very important execution.
Right, target. Yeah, it is. And even on desktop, it's tiny. I think the macOS build, once it's linked into an application, is maybe less than 500 kilobytes as well. So it's pretty small.
And I guess this is a really good use case for app bundles as well, right? So
it's,
you can have
it's a very good case for app bundles.
Per ABI.
Or APK split in general, any way you want to.
Well, yeah, but I think the problem with APK splits is unless you use an app bundle, you right. still, developers would download all of them, right? Because the Play Store, I think, only gives you the per APK, unless you yourself build a million APKs.
Right, no, yeah, you would have to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fairly small, and it also runs in the emulator. It runs really well in the emulator, so you don't even need a real device to play with it. And keeping it small is not a constant struggle, but we definitely have to be careful. So we spend a lot of time looking at the binary, and I know that Matthias, who's been on this podcast before, spends a lot of time looking at the assembly code generated by Clang to see where we can save space and performance.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Matthias actually. The original team on Filament was you and Matthias.
Yes.
And then a couple more folks now.
Yeah, and actually the original team was Matthias, Nicolas Roar, and myself.
Nicolas was on there as well before the constraint.
Well, actually, he was not working on Filament, but so what was happening, it's a fun story. After we went to work on robotics for a while, and when we came back to Android, we didn't have a desk. Because there was no room available. So we were starting two new projects. One was Filament and the other one was Constraint Layout. And so we worked for about 3 months in a library. There's a library for the legal department in the building at Google.
Building full of lawyers and you guys.
Right. So nobody knew where we were because we didn't have a desk. And it was just a bunch of lawyers. And we would just spend our days in that library working on Constraint Layout and Filament. Yeah. That was kind of fun. And sometimes the lawyers would show up and say, hey, we see you every day. What do you do here?
I don't think it was a very well-run research group because you worked on two projects, both of which saw the light of day.
Yes.
I don't think that's the way research groups are supposed
to. I just hope that Filament will have the success that Constraint Layout has, but that's it's a little more niche, so I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly I can't see every Android developer adopting this thing because it depends on whether you need this, almost photorealistic right. rendering stuff, but it's amazing if you need that thing. It seems to bring
right.
a lot
yeah,
of power.
Yeah, some of the ideas we had in mind were things like any app that does shopping, for instance, or any app that needs to showcase a real world object.
Can you walk through that in a bit more detail? Sort of give developers ideas for where they would want this in their apps. So
right,
shopping. What's the example there?
Right. So Filament is designed so that you can work just as a view. So it doesn't have to be full screen. It doesn't have to take over the application. So for instance, for your car manufacturer, you have an app BMW has an app, Tesla has an app. They all have apps nowadays. So instead of just showing you a bitmap of your car. You could show the full 3D model, so you could show the status of the car, with the right paint and all that stuff, just to make it look nicer and have a nicer app. And for shopping, same thing. When you're looking at any object on a shopping website, furniture is a great example. That's where AR is pretty successful these days. You could show a really, really accurate rendering of the goods, so that it gives the potential buyer a better idea of what it's going to look like. For something, it's not going to matter that much, like a camera or a book, you don't care about really the appearance, but anything where the appearance matters, photos always have the problem that it's hard to gauge the size of it or some of the aspects of the materials that make the object.
Yeah, especially clothing material. You can show me that color in a swatch on your website, but I really have no idea what it's going to look like under the fluorescent lighting.
Yeah, exactly.
In my closet.
And one of the problems too, or for cars, every time you go to a website for cars, the paints look very different than they look in real life.
Yeah.
And so hopefully with 3D physically based rendering, you can get a better accurate representation.
Because you can show it under different lighting conditions.
You can show different lighting conditions, and then you can zoom on it, you can rotate around it. And so for clothing, for instance, Filament has a special, what we call material model, that's meant to recreate cloth and fabrics.
Right.
So you can have this soft aspect that most surfaces don't have.
And then can you change the environment lighting to have Chet's closet as well? Is that one of the settings in there?
Why do you care what it looks like in the closet?
Well, that's the environment map. You need to show the clothes on the floor and, just detritus hanging from the walls and stuff like that, as well as the zappy fluorescent lighting from above.
We can make that happen.
All right. Actually, so how do people see, if they don't follow you on Twitter, they should, but that's where you've been posting some of the pictures. But right. just look through the document if you want to see some examples of the stuff, just it's not just shiny spheres on checkerboards, right?
And we have different documents. There's the big ones, about a couple hundred pages. That one is like math and equations. Yeah. It looks a little scary, but it's all high school math. Trust me, because I'm really bad at math and I was able to do all this. And we have a couple other documents that are about materials. Yeah. So those are more visual and they explain how do you define a material? Like what are the parameters? It's actually very interesting. With just a few parameters, you can recreate a whole lot of real world surfaces.
So it's your material spec, but it's not the material spec now. It's confusing.
But it's interesting because what I like about physically based rendering is that even if you're not an artist, you can create reasonable looking objects and surfaces because the parameters are so easy to understand and there's so few of them that and it makes sense.
Okay, so question for you. If you're, indie developer sitting in your basement wondering how you could take advantage of this stuff, what are the tools that people use to create A, the models, B, the materials?
So there's the first thing you can do, there are tons of websites out there where you can just buy the assets. And it can be fairly cheap. I mean, like a very, very nicely modeled car, with millions of triangles, like professional kind of model. Will cost between $10 and $50. So if you really need one object, that's a solution. Same thing for textures, you can find tons of. So there's websites like Sketchfab, for instance, or Google. We have something called Poly. And for textures, there are now more and more websites where you can find free textures under Creative Commons license. So you can CC0, so you can use them for commercial use. Definitely use some of them for testing. So if you need a texture of concrete or, for instance, you can just go to those websites, download the textures and feed them to Filament directly, and it's just going to work. There are also, and for tools, a popular free tool is Blender. It's an open source renderer and modeler. So it's nice because it has all the features you need. It also does physically based rendering, so you can test everything in Blender before you export to Filament. For texturing, they're not free, but there's a couple of tools I really like called Substance Designer and Substance Painter. Substance Designer will be appealing to any engineer because it's procedural texturing. So you create a graph of nodes that compute textures, so everything is procedurally generated. And they have a large library. They have something called Substance Source and Substance Share. You can subscribe and you have access to thousands of materials. And when you see what people do procedurally, like the other day I saw car headlights generated entirely procedurally. I'm not sure how they do that, but apparently they can.
So you talked about textures. What about materials? Because that's not like...
All right. So textures are a big part of the material. So the way... I need to describe the material system a little bit. So our default material model takes only four parameters, and really there's only three that you care about most of the time. So the first one is what we call the base color. So what is the color of an object? Then there's the metallicity, so it's whether or not the object is a metal. So far it's pretty easy to figure those settings out because
you mean material now, right?
Material, okay, or the surface.
It's like an object's going to have different materials on it.
Exactly. Okay. And the third one is called the roughness, and basically it's how smooth the material is or not. And what you can do is when you look at those websites, they give you textures for those parameters. So they give you a color texture, a metallic texture, and a roughness texture. So what you can do is you can vary those parameters per pixel with the textures and create really complex looking objects. So most of the time, your materials can only be just a set of textures, but you can go much further and you can write actual code for your materials if you want to generate fancy things.
Interesting. I was assuming that the material was something that was just applied to the object or the surface overall, not that it would actually vary on a continual basis across
the
surface.
Thanks to the textures, because you can feed to all those parameters per pixel, and you can have like really good, like a great example is like rusty metal.
Yeah.
So rust is not a metallic surface. So you're going to create a metallic map, a metallic texture, where you're going to say, you're going to paint in white the parts that are metallic and paint in black the parts that are rusty. And then in your color texture, you're gonna change the color of the metal based on whether it's rusty or not. And then on the same object, you're gonna get both effects at the same time.
I mean, concrete is a good example as well because you have all these this porous surface, right? Where you're gonna get the normal map is gonna change continually.
A great example is just asphalt that's painted, like the paint for the lanes on the road. So those are smoother. The rest of the road is rougher. So yeah, you're also going to use textures there to vary things. And sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes you need actual several materials. So an object can be made of several sub-objects that each have a different material and different textures because maybe some parts are transparent, maybe some parts are not. Some parts are made of cloth, some are not, and you need to vary the materials.
Yeah, like eyeglasses, obviously, the lenses and the frames not going to be the same material.
But with just the three parameters, the color, the metallic, and the roughness, you can already represent like so many materials that are all around you that you don't need much more.
Again, check out the doc to see diagrams and explanations of why this stuff matters.
And I think we can commit here now that we'll get links to these things in the show notes. And if you don't know where to find that, you basically just sort of look up the Android Developers Backstage podcast. That's where we post all the show notes.
So it's pretty easy to get started. Tons of resources out there. You typically look up PBR, so physically based rendering, and textures or models, and you'll find stuff.
Cool. What didn't we ask about that we should have?
So much. But I don't think in an hour we left enough time to cover everything. Just the material models we have, there's so many other features that are supported. Like you mentioned clear coat earlier.
Yeah.
That one's an interesting one because some materials are made of several layers. So typically a car paint, there's a base metallic surface, then there's a layer of paint, then there's a layer of varnish that's transparent. And if you want to recreate something that looks like a real car, you need this concept of layering. So we have one type of layer called a clear coat where you can declare a surface that's, let's say, a rough metal, and then you can put that clear coat layer on top to get those nice sharp reflections. And that's where I was mentioning approximations earlier, so that's one of them. We only have one layer at a time, and it has to be clear coat, and it has to be transparent. And some of the interactions between the two layers are not taken into account because if you start worrying about that, you'll never be done.
This is one area where, again, I'll say go read the doc because the diagrams are really nice. So in an earlier life, I was looking into color theory stuff, specifically around paint stuff, and the computations for coming up with a color end up looking at the level. If you take a section of a piece of paint, a painted surface, there's interactions between the background, the canvas that you're painting on, and then there's a not infinitely small layer of paint in which it's not just a color. It doesn't just reflect red, rather the light. Some of it reflects off and then you get specular stuff. Some of it goes into the paint and bounces around and then comes out with that color. And then there's light refracted inside and then there's light reflecting off the canvas on the bottom. And so it's all of those interactions creating the base color, and that goes into your material descriptions. Right. And then there's the clear coat on top, which is again doing that in another layer.
Yeah, and even between, for instance, the clear coat layer and the rise that's underneath, when the light goes in and then it bounces back to come out, the reflection interactions happen both ways. Yeah. So the light might bounce, when it's trying to come out, it might bounce back inside the object and again and again. So yeah, it would be ridiculous to try to do all of this in real time. And another thing that I don't know if you actually did that when you were doing your pigment stuff, but we use, all our computations are based on RGB colors, which is completely wrong because we should be using wavelength.
Yep. And tri-stimulus.
There are some offline renderers that actually do that. They just, a light is called a black body radiator that has a color temperature, and they just know what wavelength is emitted by the...
No. Everyone knows you should be simulating photons.
That's actually a technique called photon mapping. we should be doing that, right? We should be using wavelengths instead of just RGB, because some wavelengths will be reflected differently than other wavelengths. And and thin film interference that you were talking about earlier, that's one of the primes behind it. It's very complicated, and I think there's still going to be a lot of papers to read in the future.
I have a feature request. So in 94, 95, when Toy Story came out, what was really special about that, other than being, I think, the first feature-length movie, was that they had added wear and tear to the world.
Right.
you know, they actually had gone in and put smudges and fingerprints, you know, into the scene, because that's what the real world is like. And I think, I mean, that's still what people do, right? You have to actually go in there and put your own texture maps with smudges and things like that. I think for a physically based rendering, it'd be nice if I could just say wear and tear factor equals, right? And for you to then go and sort of just do this, right? Make these objects not so perfect that the model says, and I shouldn't have to go in myself and place these things there.
So that's typically done in the materials. So a tool like Substance Designer, I was mentioning earlier, where you procedurally create materials, they have that. They tend to have parameters that you can change before you generate the textures.
But what if I want the wear and tear to be sort of scene global, not on a per object? So let's say I want dust, right? That isn't something I would place on the object uniformly. It sort of should come from where it's placed in the scene and sort of...
Yep.
Right?
And that's, again, the kind of approximations we kind of have to do because it becomes complicated.
Yep.
And the problem with that one is the type of wear and tear. Like, it depends what you want. Like, do you want your hardwood floor to be scratched, or do you want to have paint left by your toy?
Oh, I want a whole Kotlin DSL to filament that would basically describe the world wear and tear that I want you to apply.
One thing I wanted to add to filament is a wetness factor to be able to make surfaces wet, because we can change the way they're rendered, and it works pretty well.
Just need a dingy factor. The other suggestion I would have for that feature is to get an environment map of either my desk or my closet, and then you could just sort of automatically apply my particular mess to any scene.
You can do that. Just take a picture of your desk and you're good to go.
Yeah.
All right.
Right.
We could probably go all day on this. I think all of us are computer graphics hobbyists.
Yeah.
So
let's do
parting. Yeah, I think we will.
Yeah, so check out the GitHub. I'm going to add more samples for Android and hopefully copy the documentation from the C++ APIs to the Java APIs so you can see JavaDoc.
Yep.
Or if you want to do this, like, I'll be happy to approve the PR.
Cool.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks.